Good afternoon, and I'm delighted to be part of this panel. Dr. Kron invited me to be part of this panel because in April, I was part of another session where many of you may know that my work is predominantly on the impacts of racism on the health and well-being of the nation. But I was invited to think about how ableism and racism had parallels, had intersections, and then I started really thinking about how we could how people interested in those two sort of strands could braid the strands and we could draw strength and lessons from one another. So I'm going to share with you, first of all, a framework for understanding levels of health intervention in general. Then I'm going to define racism and expand that to a definition of any structured inequity, including ableism. I'll share with you some data on disability by race and by social class. And then finally, I'm going to just share with you some of my musings, some themes that I hope will prompt some discussion among all of us later. So, I'm going to start out with a cartoon animation to illustrate different levels of health intervention. Here we go. Doot, 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 doot. Whoops! Boom! Somebody has just fallen off of the cliff of good health. And if that were you, or if it were somebody in your family, you would be delighted to find an ambulance there at the bottom of the cliff to speed you on to care. But if we were concerned about others who might come along this cliff, if we're concerned about public health, population health, community health, we might well ask ourselves, what do we need to put in place as a health intervention besides just stationing lots of ambulances there at the bottom? So somebody in this room might say, I know, let's put a net halfway down because people will fall, but at least you can catch them before they get crunched up at the bottom. But then we say, well, you know, nets have holes in them, so some people might fall through the cracks. So we might even make that a trampoline halfway down. No holes in a trampoline, right? But even if we have a trampoline halfway down that cliff, we might find ourselves with lots of people just bouncing up and down at half functionality, not able to get back to the top of the cliff. So what else can we put in place as a health intervention? Well, certainly somebody's going to say, let's put a fence at the edge of the cliff to keep people from falling in the first place. And that's a great idea. But, you know, that's going to have to be a very, very strong fence if there's a lot of population pressure against it. So what else can we do as a health intervention? We can move the population away from the edge of the cliff. So I'm going to label these interventions that I've shared with you so far, where the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff represents medical care and tertiary prevention, preventing the secondary conditions, as you say, you know, preventing the, if you have some kind of injury, then what's going to happen after that? So I think in terms of chronic diseases, preventing the amputations from diabetes, the like. So that's your ambulance. The net or trampoline halfway down, these are our safety net programs and secondary prevention, early detection screening programs. The fence represents primary prevention, keeping things from happening in the first place, like immunizations. And moving the population away from the edge of the cliff is about addressing the social determinants of health, like neighborhood conditions and poverty and opportunities, you know, the resources through the VA, educational opportunities, all of that. And this is a nice little diagram. We could, in any field of public health or for health in general, we might have a conversation, say with the Department of Health and Human Services or the Veterans Administration, and say, how should we be spending our resources? How much should be in ambulances versus nets, fences versus moving the population away from the edge? But so far, this diagram, as useful as it might be for structuring conversations with communities or among policymakers, so far, it doesn't talk about how health disparities might arise. So I want you to keep this cliff in the back of your mind. I'm going to talk about how health disparities arise on three levels, and then we'll come back to the cliff. Now, as you know, a lot of my work is on race and racism. So when I think about how health disparities arise, I'm usually thinking that context, but this deals for many, many different axes of inequity. When we talk about racial ethnic health disparities, we unfortunately have lots of evidence about differences in the quality of care received within the healthcare system. But that's also true for people with different levels of ability and disability. Many people are frustrated because of the differences in the quality of care they receive within the healthcare system, even the ability to get up on an examining table, for example. But the Institute of Medicine, which documented in 2002 a lot of the racial ethnic differences in quality of care. They said, you know, that's not the only thing going on. There's another level at which things are happening. That's differences in access to health care in the first place. But even before people are sick enough to seek health care, there are differences in our life opportunities, exposures, and stresses that are making some individuals and communities sicker than others in the first place. And when you think about three levels at which health disparities can arise, differences in quality of care, differences in access to care, or differences in underlying exposures and opportunities, really it's like a big pyramid or a huge iceberg, and the hidden base of it are the differences in the quality of our lives. And then you sometimes have sicker people who are the ones who are frustrated because of difficulty accessing the system. And then sometimes even the lucky ones are further injured because of differences in the quality of care that they receive. So now we're going to go back to our cliff thinking about these three levels at which health disparities arise. But now we're going to realize that we're really not dealing with a flat, two-dimensional cliff, but actually we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff. And at some parts of the cliff, there might be an ambulance there, but maybe that ambulance has a flat tire, so it's slow or goes off in the wrong direction. Or maybe there's no ambulance there at all, and maybe there's no net nor fence. And usually, at those parts of the cliff, the population is being pushed closer to the edge. So now I'm going to label these observations about our three-dimensional cliff with how health disparities arise. Where the differences in quality of care, that's when the ambulance is there, but it's slow or goes off in the wrong direction. Differences in access to care are no ambulance, no net, no fence. Differences in access to care, no ambulance, no net, no fence. And differences in underlying exposures and opportunities, that's represented by the closer proximity of that green population to the edge. Now, you'll remember that I talked about moving the population away from the edge of the cliff as addressing the social determinants of health. But now that we recognize that we're dealing with a three-dimensional cliff, we have other questions that need to be answered. For example, how did the cliff become three-dimensional in the first place? And that's usually because of historical injustices that have been perpetuated by present-day contemporary structural factors. But given that you have a three-dimensional cliff, we also need to figure out why are there differences in how resources are distributed along this cliff face, and why are there differences in who's found at different parts of the cliff? And why are the orangies back here in a way and the greenies being pushed closer to the edge? And when you start engaging in asking these questions and trying to answer these questions, you're now addressing what I describe as the social determinants of equity, which are different from the social determinants of health. The social determinants of equity are systems of power that have the power to distribute resources and populations. So they include our isms. Racism, sexism, ableism, heterosexism, all of these systems of power. And so what I've actually done here is distilled in this cliff analogy three dimensions of health intervention, where the first, our health services, can be displayed along a line actually at the edge of the cliff, your ambulance, net, and fence. And when we say health in this country, people will usually complete that thought for you and say health care or health services. And actually, a lot of our conversation when we say health is really about these things. And I think everybody would agree that it would be wonderful to have universal access to high quality health care in all of these. But that in and of itself is not going to result in large and sustained improvements in health outcomes or the elimination of health disparities. We already said we need to move into that second dimension and address the social determinants of health by moving the population away from the edge of the cliff, addressing poverty and neighborhood conditions and opportunities and the like. But then we also recognize that if we do not understand that we are dealing with a three-dimensional cliff, we may move some of the population away from the edge of the cliff, but not move all of the population away from the edge of the cliff, and we might actually make health disparities worse. And so we also need to move into that third dimension and address the social determinants of equity, all of our isms, racism, sexism, ableism, heterosexism, and the like. So this is a framework on which I find it interesting, and an exercise I did for myself was to say, okay, how is our current public health policy addressing some of these different levels that I have described in terms of levels of health intervention? And in Healthy People 2020, the public health, you know, plan for the nation, there are currently 20 disability and health objectives. And so I read through those, and this is my sorting of how I thought they related. How many of them were dealing with the ambulance? Well, I felt that there were three, and I'm not going to read them for you, but I'll let you have a minute to look at the three that I thought were at that ambulance level, medical care or tertiary prevention. And then there were four that I felt were at that net or trampoline level, that is, early detection, screening, safety net programs. Then there were six that I felt were fences. I think that's nice to have six fences. So here they are, and I'll let you just scan them. We could read them and discuss them at length, but I have other things I also want to share with you, so I'll let you read these. And then there were actually five that I thought were about addressing the social determinants of health, which in my mind is really delicious because, you know, in all of this, we need to have something at all of these levels, don't we? Right? And to be effective, we need to be working at all of these levels. And there were even two that I considered to be about addressing the social determinants of equity. So we're going to move on now, and I'm going to move into sharing a definition of racism, which is the basis of my work, which can be generalized to be a definition of any structured inequity. Because, again, we're looking at parallels, intersections, and braiding the strands. So when I talk about racism, I'm very clear that I'm talking about a system. That is, I'm not talking about an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing or even a psychiatric illness, as some people have suggested. But I'm talking about a system of power. And it's a system of doing what? It's a system of structuring opportunity and of assigning value. And on what basis is the opportunity structured and on what basis is the value assigned? It's based on the social interpretation of how we look, which is what we call race in this country. So, for example, here in Boston, you look at me, I'm clearly black. In some parts of Brazil, you'd look at me and I'd be just as clearly white. In South Africa, you'd look at me, I'd be clearly colored. And in all three of those places, I'd have the same appearance, but the social interpretation of my appearance would put me into different racial categories. And if I stayed in any of those places long enough, my health outcome would probably take on that of the group to which I've been assigned. What are the impacts of this system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on race? It unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities. When we think about it at all, that's where we go. But it doesn't take long to recognize that every unfair disadvantage has its reciprocal unfair advantage, so that racism is also unfairly advantaging other individuals and communities. That's the whole issue of unearned white privilege, which we hardly ever talk about in this country. But then even as we recognize we have a system that's either unfairly disadvantaging or unfairly advantaging others, racism is sapping the strength of our whole society through the waste of human resources. And I could give you many examples of that. I'll just give you one, the way that we're not investing in the full excellent public education of all of our kids because of the blinders of racism making us believe that there's no genius in the barrios or in the ghettos or on the reservations, that we can get along very well, thank you, without those kids. And yet, if we were to invest in the full excellent public education of all of our kids, we could be doing so much better as a nation or as a world. So this definition of racism can actually be generalized to be a definition of any structured inequity. So you could say, what is ableism? Well, that's a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on on ability status that unfairly disadvantages some, unfairly advantages others, and saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. What is sexism? It's a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on gender that unfairly disadvantages some, unfairly advantages others, and saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. And in fact, there are many, many axes of inequity operating in our society in general, and in individuals, including race, gender, ethnicity, disability status, and on and on. And what's interesting about these is that these are at least all serving as risk markers for how opportunity is structured and value is assigned, and many, if not most of them, are not actually risk factors in getting to disease. So now, because I only have 20 minutes and I'm going to race along, and I hope we'll have time for discussion afterward, I'm going to switch again, and I'm going to share some data that actually my co-presenter, Steve Kay, provided me with. This is from the American Community Survey in 2011. And we're going to explore now disability status by race and income. So the group that I'm going to show you now, because we have limited time, these are working age adults from 45 to 64 years of age. And what I have is what we usually think about when we talk about disparities, especially in the racial context. We usually just say, like, boom, okay, you know, black, I think it's like 22% versus 14% for white in that age group report some disability from those. It was from all six questions. Steve, yes. So this is interesting, right? And you might not think more about it, but if we also look and stratify by income, look at that. At every income level, from less than the federal poverty level to 100 to 199% of the federal poverty level, 200 to 299%, 300 to 499%, and then 500% plus, blacks do have excess at each level, but it's very close, much closer than you would have thought looking at the aggregate numbers. And that is because the distribution of people by income is not uniform. What I have displayed on the bottom there is the proportion of the population in each of those income levels that is black. And the line going across there is the proportion of the population that is black. And so you see that black people are overrepresented in those lower income levels, the lower three, and underrepresented at the higher income levels. Here we have the proportion that are white versus not white, and that line is the proportion of the population that's white. White people are underrepresented at this higher, at the lower educational, not education, income levels, and overrepresented at the higher income levels. And that's what got us to that. I'm going to just go back so you can see this again, to that. Right? And that's quite interesting, right? But there's even more interesting about this. By the way, this kind of graph that I'm showing you is a graph that I am trying to popularize at the Centers for Disease Control and everything. I call it my Gartner's Tail plot. That's another whole conversation. I haven't quite published it yet. I presented it a few times. I mean, there are abstracts about it. But this kind of graph where you have a health outcome, some kind of social class measure, by race, and then the underlying distribution of race by that social class measure to help us really understand what is going on, right? So now let's look at a Hispanic-white comparison. Here, you don't even know I have a Hispanic-white comparison because 14.8% of the Hispanic population, 45 to 64, and 14.8% of the white population, ages 45 to 64, report a disability. But if we look now, stratified by income, at all levels, until the highest income level, white people are actually reporting more disability. Do you see that? And the reason that we saw that the aggregate numbers were the same is, again, because here we have percent Hispanic. The line across is the percent Hispanic in the population. Hispanic people are overrepresented at the lower income levels, and white people, again, are overrepresented at the higher income levels. So those are my data things. I hope that will be good for conversation. And so I'm going to get to the last bit, which is just what are some of the parallels and what are some of the contrasts when you consider race as an axis of inequity and disability status as an axis of inequity? Well, race is a group attribute, whereas disability status is very much an individual attribute, although people are now coming together as a protected class, you know, given a legal status as a group. But race is a group attribute, which actually is not an individual attribute at all. As I illustrated for you, I mean, we are now measuring what we call socially assigned race. How do other people usually classify you in this country? And depending on where you stand, you can have a different racial classification, right? But it's a group attribute that takes meaning because of what's going on with the racial climate in your society. Much longer conversation. Sorry I even started that because that's a much longer conversation. But there you have that contrast. Well, race is deemed to be immutable in our context, whereas in disability status, there's some recognition that the status can change. And some people have even talked about temporarily able-bodied as a kind of status. For both with regard to race and with regard to disability status, there are assumptions that are being made about the value of the individual. And There are structural barriers in both. The structural barriers with regard to race are sometimes invisible and ignored, and some people even deny the existence of racism, right? With disability status, the structural barriers, maybe even like ramps versus not, are often visible, but still sometimes ignored. More musings. And I mean, I'm just going to put them in dependence versus independence in terms of, I guess, somebody who is disabled or, you know, somebody who's temporarily able-bodied and in terms of race as a thing, you know, are you dependent or independent? Are you talking about an identity or a condition? What is the salience of advocacy in both groups? And, you know, I don't know, I would think maybe advocacy is more salient right now in the disability community than it is even in the racial ethnic communities. What is the visibility versus the invisibility factor in terms of visibility versus invisibility of abilities? You know, we had some discussion of that before, and of barriers. What about the social construction of able-bodiedness versus of race? And what about the role of the interaction with the environment? Because, you know, if you have a conducive environment and something that would be a disability in a non-conducive environment, you can be quite well functional in another. And the social construction of race and the interaction with the environment there, that is race as a completely socially constructed variable. What about the mechanisms of accommodation, the role of segregation, both with regard to race and with able-bodied versus disabled? And what about universal human rights versus a minority or underserved status? These are just things that we could kind of riff on for a long time. In the end, I think it's difficult for any of us to recognize systems of inequity that advantage oneself. It's difficult for men to recognize sexism. It's difficult for white people in this country to recognize racism. It's difficult for able-bodied people to recognize ableism. It is difficult for Americans to recognize our American privilege. And it's especially difficult when you're disadvantaged by other systems of inequity. So we have the intersection sometimes of disability and minority status and people, and then you have some people who have only minority status, some people who only have disability status. All of this is going on, but it's especially difficult to recognize systems of inequity that are privileging you if you have some other thing that you feel burdened by. I think it's quite interesting. We could do research in examining which of many multiple identities is more salient in a given setting. Is your gender more salient, your disability status, your race, whatever, more salient? But I think we need to avoid the game of whose oppression is worse. And finally, in terms of parallels, both ableism and racism are systems of inequity, like sexism, heterosexism, like that structure opportunity and assigned value. These things intersect sometimes in the same individual, and they certainly intersect in communities, even if not in the same individual. And I think because of that, and if we recognize these parallels and these intersections, that we can braid the strands, as I said, and build convergent strengths. We can expand advocacy agendas so that the racial ethnic advocacy can include disability advocacy, and the disability advocacy can include racial ethnic advocacy. We don't have to be off in very separate and maybe sometimes even competing camps. I think we can integrate our research agendas, and we can share successful policy strategies. And I actually had taken out, you said that each of us was going to do something international, and I actually took out a reference to the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which Dr. Kron mentioned was signed by the U.S. in 2009 but hasn't yet been ratified. I'd just like to end by asking you, have you ever heard of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination? Anybody heard of that? Nobody. Right. What that is an international anti-racism treaty that was signed, that was actually voted into force by the UN General Assembly way back in 1965. Do you think the U.S. has signed this? No. like what? Oh, I never heard of it. But yes, the U.S. did sign it in 1966, but maybe we're in the same situation, right, that the Senate never ratified it because, you know, in order for a treaty to have force, the Senate has to ratify it. Do you think the U.S. Senate has ratified this treaty? Yes, they have. The U.S. Senate ratified the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination 28 years later after it was signed. I hope it doesn't take that long for the other one. But in 1994, but what that means is that even today, right now, we have international treaty obligations to do right by this anti-racism treaty, which includes submitting periodic reports, which our State Department drafts every 6 years and submits to a UN committee. And that committee also gets reports from so-called shadow reports from other groups. And then they send back to the United States their concluding observations. So for our 2007 report, that's the most recent report we submitted, we got back a 14-page concluding observations in 2008. It's not a telephone book. We could all read that. And it said, "Dear United States, thank you for your report. We remain concerned about racial profiling, residential segregation, differential access to health care, the achievement gap in education, and on and on and on." They also said, "Dear United States, you need to ensure, set up a mechanism for assuring compliance with this treaty at the federal, state, and local levels. And dear United States, you need to let your general public know about the existence of the treaty." So I do my part every time I talk. And even though we were talking about disability, I am still at it. So thank you very much.